Namatu Ratanatayasa. Welcome everyone to today's lecture on basic Buddhism. And again, basic does not mean Buddhism for dummies, it just means things which are fundamental or essential to the Buddhist path. And can sometimes be sort of a Buddhism for dummies in the sense that we don't expect or I try not to expect a lot of previous knowledge of Buddhism. Though a lot of what I talk about might be unfamiliar, it should be sort of on the level of people who don't know a lot about Buddhism, should be able to grasp it, or at least get a superficial understanding of what's being said. So today I wanted to talk about the sort of the nature of the universe according to Buddhism. And by Buddhism I sort of mean classical Buddhism in a general sense, without getting into specific practices. With emphasis on the direction that one's life can take. Because if anyone knows anything about Buddhism, usually we understand that Buddhism is a path that one follows, a path of practice, a way of behaving through body, through speech, and through mind. It's the abstinence from certain acts which are deemed to cause suffering or lead to trouble, lead to stress, lead to a bad result. And the undertaking, the encouraging, and the development of those things which lead to progress, which lead to happiness, which lead to freedom from suffering, which lead to peace. So I think it goes without saying that Buddhism is a very practical religion. And I use the word religion here in its etymological sense of being the opposite of negligence. Negligence and religions being opposites. Negligence being a state of living where one does bad things, says bad things, and thinks bad things with impunity, without thinking that they might possibly have repercussions. Where one is not at all interested in doing good deeds, saying good things, and thinking good thoughts. Developing oneself. This is a negligent way of living. And so Buddhism is a religion in the sense that it's a way of being where we take life sort of seriously and we try to grab the bull by the horns and make something out of our lives, make our lives useful and take up the time that we have. And to make progress in our lives. And I'd like to talk about how this bears on second life, because you know, in real life, when we teach Buddhism, we're always thinking about teaching people how to live their lives, not preaching, not proselytizing, but when we give to people, when trying to explain or give something useful to people, it means that we're trying to help people to organize their lives and live their lives in a way that's going to be beneficial, helpful, and useful for them. In real life, this is easy to understand, but in second life, we often lose sight of the fact that there are the very same mechanisms going on in our minds at the time when we engage in the various objects and people and so on that we meet with in second life. And we're dealing with the same states of mind as we would in real life. And so in that sense, as I've said before, it is a form of real life. But what happens in a place like this is because we understand that we can do whatever we want, say whatever we want, and think whatever we want with impunity, without any repercussions, because we can always log off. We don't realize that it's actually affecting our minds when we do and say and think things, even in here, that we are actually having an effect on other people, and we have the ability to help them, to make them, give them comfort, to give them peace, to give them happiness, to give them wisdom in their lives. We also have the potential to hurt and to harm and to lead them astray and lead them on the wrong path. And you can see how this plays out in a place like Second Life, in a game or in a phenomenon like Second Life, as they say, where we get involved with all sorts of things that we would never get involved with in real life, or would not dare to do and to say in real life, without really taking it seriously. And this is kind of the idea that life is a game, and not realizing that there is future consequences and that our mind is changing based on everything we say and everything we do. Well, that in fact is the essence of Buddhism, is that our karma, our actions, the way we act and speak, and of course based on the way we think and the way we intentionally do things for the purpose of hurting, for the purpose of harming, for the purpose of becoming addicted and so on, is the cause, the sole cause for suffering for us. That if we're able to do away with these things and get on the right path, that then there's nothing in the world, in any world, in any universe, that can possibly make us suffer. So today I'm going to talk about the seven paths that exist, and this is from a Buddhist point of view, and it'll touch upon some of the realms of existence. In Buddhism, we understand realms of existence to be based both, not only on the physical, but also based on the mental. So some realms are purely mental, some realms are more mental than physical, and the physical is merely a token. Some realms are, even one could say, more physical than they are mental, where the mental plays very little role, and it's mostly a instinctual existence. But understanding that there is no we're not talking about an external universe. We're talking about an internal universe, where when you die from this life, that death is only an external phenomenon, that internally, based on the mind, the reality and the chain reactions just continue. The chain reactions of body and mind simply pass on. And this is what is understood to mean rebirth. In a basic sense, it's not that we, as Buddhists, or even generally in the East, it's not that we believe in rebirth or reincarnation, it's that we don't believe in death. Death is simply a concept, something from the outside. And I can say this, it's interesting, I was interested to hear John Lennon, a quote from John Lennon, who was big into Hinduism. He said the exact same thing that I've been always explaining in terms of rebirth, is that it's not, you know, we're not afraid, he said, I'm not afraid of death, I don't believe in it. And I think this comes from sort of his Hindu influences, and I would say in Hinduism they probably have some similar understanding or of this as how death works. It's just an illusion. It's something from that we see in other people, and we never really experience a true death on our own. At the moment of death, the mind simply continues and changes. It's like one wave crashing against the shore and another wave arising. So in Buddhism, we recognize there to be seven paths, and I'll just explain these briefly to try to give you an understanding of Buddhist cosmology, with the proviso that this is all very much a mental construction that arises, the mental and the physical giving reactions and creating our future. The first path is the path to hell. So some people are sometimes surprised that in Buddhism there is an actual hell. In fact, there are hundreds of them, and they've all been given names and labels, and it's all sorts of fun stuff, and I'm not going to go into detail with that, but it's a lot like the hell of Dante's Inferno, the classical Christian hell, only it's a lot more imaginative, because as far as we understand from the records that have been left, there were actually Buddhist monks and nuns who went to these places and saw them and were able to describe them in quite graphic detail, whereas Dante's Inferno is simply a story and an imagination. These guys actually did practice meditation and were able to see these things. The second path is the path to the realm of the ghosts. So to be born as a, to be reborn as a ghost, or to become a ghost. The third realm is the realm of the animals, to be born as an animal. The fifth, the fourth path is the path to become a human. The sixth path is the path to heaven. I'm going out of order. The fourth path is the path of the human. The fifth path is the path to heaven. The sixth path is the path to God. And the seventh path is the path to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have these seven paths, and these are the seven classical Buddhist ways. And the story goes that the Buddha was listening, the monks were saying, talking about the paths that they had come when they were walking through India, and the Buddha said, look, what are you doing talking about those sort of paths? It's not really useful talk for you, when in our minds there is a much more important sort of path to consider and to think about, and that's the path of the mind, the way of the mind. And so these seven realms, I guess you could say, are sort of a categorization of the various types of existence that can occur, that can arise. And if people have questions about the various realms, then I'm happy to take questions afterwards. I'll try to give a little bit of explanation about some of them, for some of them that might sound not so familiar to a beginner audience as I go along. But I'd like to focus more on how it is that one attains these states of existence. These are the seven ways of behaving, of acting, of practicing, which lead directly to these paths through cause and effect. So the path to hell is the path of anger. Someone who is bitterly angry and full of hatred, and as a result of their anger, kills, as a result of their anger, hurts other people, says vicious things, bad things, really trying to hurt and to make people feel suffering, feel pain, and come to misery. When a person does this repeatedly and makes it habitual, then this is the cause for them to, when they die at the breakup of the body, they will be thrown into hell, cast into hell as though thrown there, as though they were picked up and placed there. It's not really what happens, but it's just how it's so certain and so immediate that it's just as if someone picked them up, decided where they were going, and threw them into hell. And whether or not you believe in things like rebirth and the afterlife and heaven and hell and so on, it bears noting that if you look at someone who is of this character, and all of these characters, you can see hell in them. You can see heaven in the people who practice in these certain ways. You can look at a person and say, that guy's in hell, or that person is like a demon, right? And we probably all can think of people who at times have looked like they were straight out of hell. And so all we're doing is extrapolating that and explaining that that's really reality, that it doesn't do anything besides that. It's not that at the moment of death, poof, there's no chain reaction. The laws of cause and effect simply cease to exist or cease to function at the moment of death. It actually continues. The other thing to bear in mind with all of these realms is that they're all, except for freedom, they're all impermanent. The path to freedom, the reason it's called freedom is because it's not impermanent. There's no returning. There's no cycling. It's the freedom from samsara. Hell is not permanent. It's not like the Christian hell where, you know, you choose the wrong god to worship and poof, oops, sorry, you're stuck. It's not like that. So they often call it purgatory. In English, they translate it into purgatory because it is you're purging your sins or so on. And it's kind of like that, but it's more like, well, you did the time, or you did the crime, now you got to do the time. There's no one making a decision or keeping you there. It's based on the power of the bad deeds. And they were so bad, they took you to a place which is horrible. And it'd be fun if I had some time to go through hell, but I don't think it's really the important point. I mean, hell is a terrible place, and it's wonderful to read about it. It kind of one of those interesting things to study about from a Buddhist point of view. I mean, they tie you to the, they nail you to the floor and chop you up with axes, and you know, cut your, make thousands of cuts in your skin, and then put you in a tub of caustic water, of acidic water, and they pound you to a pulp so that all your bones break, but your skin isn't punctured, and so on. Oh, it gets worse and worse. There's a lot of fun in there. But moving on, in the interests of time. The number two path is the path to be born as a ghost. And ghosts in Buddhism are, I guess in Eastern religions in general, if you've ever seen The Sixth Sense, it's a movie I watched about 10 years ago with Bruce Willis, that's a lot like a Buddhist conception of ghost. A ghost is someone who is still clinging. And they you normally can't see them, but there are some people who claim to be able to sense them, and sometimes you can sense them. Sometimes I think when the room gets really cold, it's a sign that there's ghosts. If you've ever had these dreams, I've often had these dreams where you wake up, it's a dream that dream about a ghost, or a dream about someone in terrible pain and suffering, and then you wake up and the room is just freezing cold, like unusually so. And okay, so maybe this is only a delusion, but one of the noteworthy things about a ghost is always cold. Because the way to become a ghost is to be someone who is greedy, full of greed, someone who steals, someone who is envious, someone who is jealous, someone who is stingy, someone who is miserly, someone who is addicted to sensual pleasures without, to the point that they steal, they even could kill, they could, they commit adultery, cheating on their partners and so on, lying, people who get into all sorts of things, like gamblers or so on, drug addicts. When they die, they're unable to move on. There's something, or oftentimes many somethings, that will keep them stuck to this realm of existence so that they can't move on, they can't go anywhere. They don't have any good merit or good karma to send them on to any other type of birth. And they haven't done any terrible deeds to make them be born as, in hell or so on, but they're just without. They haven't done any good, anything good for themselves or for other people. They haven't ever helped other people or so on, so they have no support. Their minds are lacking in support, and they know it. It kind of like when you die, it's not that anyone judges you, you judge yourself. For people who it's interesting in this case, people who have never helped other people, have never been generous, it's interesting to watch them when other people give them things. If you've ever seen this, they will often refuse help and refuse good things, refuse gifts. I've seen this in people, people who may not be bad people, but just are fairly stingy and you know, maybe greedy or so on. I'm not so much greedy, sorry, but people who are stingy. If you notice this in people who are never, always afraid to give, always shying away from anyone who asks them for anything. When you give them something, this sort of person is often, will refuse it. That's an interesting causal relationship. But this is sort of the idea of a person who becomes a ghost, is that you haven't done anything good for anybody else, so your mind doesn't have anything to give back to you, and you come to a state of having nothing. And this is a very cold, hungry, they're often called hungry ghosts. The idea is they're always hungry. This is sort of how we understand ghosts in the West as well, always wailing, always clinging, always wanting or looking for something, searching for this or that. Something that they can never find. Often in terrible torment and hunger. So this is through greed, through the defilement of greed, which is the opposite of anger. It's the attachment to good things and the inability to let go and addiction and so on. The path which leads to be born as an animal, number three, is the practice of delusion. And delusion is something that we don't have a lot of experience with, I think, sort of understanding this word delusion. We do understand the idea of ego, and it basically corresponds with, in the West, what we talk about ego, or someone who is egotistical, someone who is conceited. And I think most Western Buddhists have this idea, have this understanding of ego and letting go of the ego. What we're talking about in delusion is, it's not only ego, but that plays a big part in it. Ego, conceit, holding ourselves above other people, holding on to the idea of self, and so on. But really, when we talk about being reborn as an animal, we are talking simply about ignorance. So we're looking at people who aren't interested in meditation, aren't interested in wisdom, aren't interested in listening to talks like this or learning things, new things, aren't interested in developing themselves. Sort of the people who eat, sleep, chase after sensual pleasures, and think that that is the ultimate of existence. Sometimes these people who say that they're living for the day or living for the moment or seize the day or so on, but in the end it's just a very hedonistic, ignoble sort of existence, which really has no causal basis as far as leading to any type of happiness. It's simply leading to greater and greater addiction or getting one into a rut. We're talking about the people who live their lives without any interest in developing themselves, people who only have interest in the very carnal facts of existence. It's not necessarily out of greed, it's just these sort of simple people. Often we term them rednecks or if you go into the rural parts of most countries, you'll find people like this, whether it be in Asia or in the West or all parts in between. And you can look at some people. These are often people who take drugs and alcohol. If you look at people who are alcoholics, there's not much difference about them and say, a dog or a cat. You don't see, in fact, sometimes you think that your cat is probably smarter than some of these people and so on. And so the understanding is that when these people pass away, their low state of mind or their sort of the mush that their brain has become will lead them on to be born in a corresponding realm, that they don't have the karmic potential to come back as a human. They are now in the realm of being an animal, and so when they die, they are born in a corresponding realm. People who you sort of look at them and they're really on that sort of a path. There's not much difference between them and animals, and it's not. I'm not asking you to judge people, it's just kind of an observation that there are certain people who are interested in spiritual and in high things, and there are other people who certainly are not. And those are the sort of people that, especially if it leads them to kill, to steal, most especially if it leads them to break moral precepts, like they're killing just out of delusion. People who are hunters, if you've ever seen these people who hunt and kill, sometimes just for sport, just for fun, not necessarily out of anger, but simply hunters or farmers or so on. People who steal because, just for the kicks or so on. People who lie and people who take drugs and alcohol, especially drugs and alcohol, I suppose, which is really the killer of mindfulness. People who say that they can take some alcohol and it doesn't make them drunk or so on. Well, it's only a matter of degree, I think. To the degree that you drink in intoxicating beverages, to that degree your mind is dulled and you've become more like an animal to that extent. More like a primitive animal. More primitive, I guess. That's the number three. The number four path is the path that we've all found ourselves on. It's the path of the human being. For someone to be reborn as a human being, they have to keep basic morality. They don't have to do anything else. But for, say, an animal to become a human, a primitive animal to become a human being, requires one to keep moral precepts. One has to refrain in general from killing, from stealing, from committing adultery, from lying. I don't exactly know how an animal could, just sexual or sensual abstention or moderation, not abstention, but moderation. And, drugs and alcohol. I mean, in the sense of us as humans, wanting to come back as humans, for all of us, for sure, the basic requirements for being born as a human are the five precepts, these five moral precepts. And if we can't keep them in general, and it doesn't mean that you have to keep them perfectly, the idea is that in general you hold by these. You can fairly easily be born as a human again. And of course, it's not an easy thing for people to live by these things. That's why they say being born as a human is not an easy thing. But you don't have to do anything great to be a human. It means you don't have to do a lot of amazing deeds or wonderful acts for other people. That's what leads one to be born in heaven in a Buddhist, from a Buddhist point of view. In Buddhism, heaven is a lot like hell in the sense that it's not permanent. It's based on your deeds. It's not based on a god or a higher being. It's not based on luck. It's a state of mind. And it's sort of the opposite corresponding opposite with hell. Whereas hell is totally unpleasant, totally undesirable. Heaven is totally pleasant and totally desirable. It's a wonderful sort of vacation from the suffering inherent in samsara. But again, we understand it's only a temporary vacation. Sorry. And how one gets to heaven is through doing good deeds. These are the do-gooders, the people who are kind to others, who help other people, people who are religious in the sense of keeping to high moral precepts, not ever telling a lie, watching their speech, not blabbering or gossiping, and people who are kind and generous, people who are interested in good deeds, people who are helpful to other people, people who study, who listen, who learn, who are respectful, who have all sorts of higher states of mind. And these are the sort of people you can pick out of a crowd. If you've ever met someone like this, or maybe there are even some people here in the crowd, but thinking of other people, if you look at other people, you can often tell you can often pick them out of a crowd and say that person is quite special. And if anyone's going to heaven, then I would say that person is among them. It's hard to tell, but you can sort of get the idea, and I'm just trying to give you an idea of the sort of people we're talking about. I met a person once who I always think about, and I was spending some time with her family when I was young. And I remember we were walking in the downtown area, and suddenly we were just talking on a cold winter day, and suddenly she ducked into McDonald's. She said, "Wait a second," and she went into the McDonald's and came out with a hamburger and gave it to this man who was sitting by the side of the curb, who I hadn't even seen, and gave him some nice words and encouragement, and gave him the hamburger, and then came back and walked on as if nothing had happened. And here I'm standing there kind of ashamed that I hadn't even seen the guy, and I wouldn't have ever thought to do such a thing. And she started telling me, just in a matter-of-fact sort of way, that she didn't give to people, she never did good deeds for other people's benefit. She did good deeds because she was selfish. She said, I don't help people because I think it's helping them. I do it for my own good. I'm just being selfish. She said, when I give to other people, it makes me happy, and that's why I do it. I thought it was an interesting sort of thing. At the time, I had no clue about where I stood on the idea. I was a kid at the time. But, you know, looking back on it from a Buddhist perspective, it's really half of it's a full half of the picture, is that really we're not doing good deeds just for other people. It's a karmic thing. It's something that makes us feel better about ourselves. It's a good deed. It's something that elevates our mind. And this is why one is able to get into heaven. It's not because you gave to this person and then God writes it down on a gold plate somewhere, and then when you get up to the gates, he says, okay, you did this and that's good, or that person can be your witness. It's really cause and effect. Your mind becomes pure and you feel happy and clear-minded. Your mind is elevated. The sixth path is the path to God. And so here we have to distinguish between angels and gods. And these are sort of my words. I don't hear this a lot, but it's pretty obvious that that's what's meant. I just don't think it's been widely used. These two words have not been widely used for these meanings. Angel is a heavenly being, a lot like the angels that we understand in the Western traditions. They might have wings. they might not, they are radiant, might have halos or so on. And otherwise they're a lot like human beings. They have arms and legs and limbs, and they eat food. They don't urinate, they don't defecate, but they do eat heavenly food, and it all gets used up, and life is just good for them. It's kind of like a paradise. God is a whole different issue, and gods in Buddhism, it's a it's not a theistic religion, but it's got a pantheon, or I don't even know how you'd say it. It's got this realm, let's put it this way. There's a realm of people who could be termed gods, of beings that could be termed gods, in one sense. Now, the only reason they're called gods is, I guess, because we have no other word for it. And also because there are certain religions that worship these beings, whereas in Buddhism we certainly do not. A god is a being that doesn't have arms, doesn't have legs, that in some cases is only mind, is only a mental. In other cases is physical, but only in the sense of having bright light or a very immaterial sort of ethereal form. And in other respects is a lot like an angel, I suppose, except lives a much longer time and doesn't eat, doesn't carry on in sensuality. It's kind of just a mind, a fixed state of being, kind of thinking like a being out in the depths of outer space, sort of with the mind encompassing the whole of the universe kind of thing. It's just a heightened state of being, and any one of us could become God, and this is a very Hindu thing to discuss and to talk about and to practice. In the Hindu religions, there is a great tradition of the idea of becoming one with God, and that's considered to be the highest. And, I mean, it goes without saying that in the Western Abrahamic traditions, this also is the case. Becoming one with God does play a part in those religions. How do you become a god is through the practice of Hindu-type meditations, or even many Buddhist meditations. If you practice meditation based on a concept, and these are a lot of the meditations I've been hinting and talking about in my other talks, this is the kind of thing that leads you to be born as a god, or in the god realms, as it could be as a part of the retinue of the gods, or so on. It could be as a great god, depending on one's attainment. And all these things do is they fix and focus the mind. They create a state of mind which is fixed, which is sometimes unlimited, where one is able to, as a human being, comprehend the whole of the universe, can hold the whole of the universe in their attention. And if one is able to develop this to the point where it becomes one's awareness, one's way of seeing, then at the point when one dies, this is where the mind goes. The mind continues that, it does away with this totally unrelated physical form. That just disappears, and there's only this state of awareness, often very vast, expansive awareness. If you've ever heard these people talk about near-death experiences or so on, where they have these experiences of the vastness of the universe, it's sort of that thing that we're talking about. This doing away with, shedding off of the physical and the limited. But as well, this is only based on the effort that is put in by the meditator. When someone practices these meditations, it's nothing to do with wisdom, so it's merely the force of concentration that leads one to be born in these realms. When that force is used up, one then has to return to continue on based on one's other karma and other actions. Everything is cause and effect. So again, the gods are not eternal as they believe often that they are, and they are not the highest as they believe often that they are. The number seven path is the path to freedom. And the path to freedom is the coincidentally, it's the Buddhist path. It's the path that the Buddha taught. So the Buddha, just to be clear, that the Buddha didn't teach any of these other paths. He taught the path which he called was the path to freedom. And it's not becoming a god. It's not going to heaven. It's not any state of becoming again. It's a state where the mind becomes free, like a bird that is let go of the tree It has looked through the whole tree and found no fruit, nothing that could possibly satisfy it. And instead of clinging, instead of being limited by the tree, it flies away. It is a mind which is not subject to old age, subject to sickness, or subject to death. This is what is meant by freedom. It's a mind. It's a reality which is free from suffering. And the path which leads to freedom is the Eightfold Noble Path, which I've mentioned, I think, in my talk last week, was based on the Eightfold Noble Path. So I won't go into great deal with that here. Basically, it's broken down into three parts. This is the Buddhist way of practice. It's the practice first of morality, where we refrain from certain states of immorality. And not only in the sense of not doing them, but also developing our mind so that our mind is straight. Our mind has no inclination to do or to say bad things, where it would never even arise in our mind. Our mind is so clear and aware of reality that the idea to kill or to hurt or to steal or to lie or to cheat or to take drugs or alcohol just wouldn't arise in the mind. Once we have morality, then it's the development of concentration. Once our mind is not interested in doing or saying these unwholesome and distracting sort of actions and speeches, modes of speech, then the mind starts to calm down. The mind starts to focus, since it only wanders in wholesome things. It's only thinking and dealing with things which are helpful, which are beneficial. The mind starts to quiet down, and especially through the practice of meditation, where the mind really starts to focus, in this case, on the reality that it is presented with. So everything that we see, it's able to see this clearly, it's able to focus and to settle down on it. When we see bad things, we don't get angry, we don't get afraid. People who see police officers can often become afraid because they know they've done something wrong. It sort of works this way in all cases, that we tend to get jumpy when we do or say, when we're immoral or when our minds are not focused. There's a funny thing about meditators that often there can be loud noises and everyone jumps, except for the meditators. And you can always tell who's a meditator because they don't jump and they don't even turn their head to look. I remember when I was just finished my first ever meditation course, and I got out and we went back into the Chiang Mai city in northern Thailand. There were two of us together, and we're sitting there in a cafeteria, and this waitress walks by and drops a whole stack of dishes or something, a huge loud crash, and everyone in the restaurant gasps and turns and looks, except for the two of us, and we're just sitting there hearing, and then we look at each other and say, "Whoa, you can tell you're a meditator when." Kind of those sort of things, these sort of experiences where your mind is focused, and so you don't react to the experiences around you. As you don't react to them, you're able to see them clearly. You're able to see them for what they are. And as a result of being able to see them for what they are, this is what leads one to freedom. When you don't cling to things, when you don't cling to anything, this is the wisdom, the third part of the path. When wisdom arises, it's not like concentration where you have to work at it and it just comes again and again. It's an understanding of the way things work, an understanding of what leads to suffering and what leads to happiness, an understanding of the nature of things, that they are not satisfying, they are not pleasant, they are not controllable, they are not permanent. They come and they go, and there's nothing to be said or done about them except to let them go and let them be and give them up. Once one really gets a picture of this, this is where the mind lets go. It's like the bird that sees nothing of any value in the tree, sees no fruit. When the mind sees it, there's no external object that could possibly make us truly happy. The mind then lets go and finds true peace and true happiness. This is what is meant by the path of freedom. And so this is a basic understanding of the universe according to the Buddha, as far as I understand it. So that's all for today. Thank you for listening. If there are any questions, I'll take them now. So jhanas are not needed for enlightenment. Jhana is a really interesting topic. It's not one for basic Buddhism, but since you brought it up, I'm happy to talk about it. The word jhana in classical Buddhism, again, this is the only Buddhism that I'm really familiar with, Theravada as we're known, is of two types. So if you look in the commentaries where the jhanas are really explained, I mean, as far as the Buddha explains jhana, it could be a lot of different things. I mean, it's pretty clear, it's just not nearly as, you know, I mean, it's not the jhanas in terms of being a samatha practice or so on. The jhanas in the commentaries are broken up into two kinds. And understanding that the word jhana simply means to meditate or to fix or to focus on. It's a state of concentration or a state of meditation. You consider it to be levels of meditation. And the first type of jhana is called Lakanupani jhana, the first one is Aramanupani jhana, which is meditation fixed or focused on a aramana, which is an object. And here it's the meaning is the 40 objects of meditation, which are examples of conceptual meditation in classical Buddhism. So this is samatha practice, and this is certainly not necessary for enlightenment. Meditation on a concept is not necessary. But the other type of jhana is called lakkhanupani jhana. It's meditation which is fixed, where the mind is fixed or focused on the lakkhana, the three characteristics. And lakkhana means impermanent suffering and non-self. So, and this is directly from the commentaries, which are the sort of the basis for this idea of the jhanas as being a samatha practice. So people always argue that the Buddha said jhanas are necessary, and so therefore samatha meditation is necessary. Well, samatha meditation is really only a commentarial thing. I mean, as far as the Buddha put it, it could simply mean a focused state of mind, and it could very well be the same practice as vipassana. But when it's broken up into two, then in the commentaries it's because they consider there to be two types of jhana. Two types of absorption. One is absorbed on a conceptual object which doesn't give you insight into impermanent suffering and non-self. Cyrus, I think that jhanas are states of absorption, not the ultimate truth. Yes, but if you're not, they're states of focus. If you're not focused on ultimate reality, you'll never understand it. So that's why even vipassana meditation is understood to be the practice of jhana. The practice of meditation, the practice of being fixed. Well, I hope it's helpful. If you're really interested, you can check out some of the videos that are on YouTube about how to meditate. There's some different ways of meditating on YouTube. I have some on my channel if you're interested. Just one more point on that is that understanding the word jhana, it's the same as the word chan or zen, which we understand, you know, zen to be a whole school of Buddhism. It's just a word that means meditation. You know, zen is the meditation school. They believe you just sit, you don't study or anything, so they focus on meditation. So that's really what the word means. Jayata pikave, I think, is the Pali. It means meditate, O monks. It doesn't mean absorbable monks. It means go off in the forest and meditate. There are the trees, there are the empty huts. Jayata bhikkhave, go meditate. Well, thanks for coming. Yeah, in the Samanyapala Sutta, it's talking about the Samatha Jhanas. It's talking about a state. Well, to understand in that sense, then yeah, I think that's important to talk about as well. We understand in Buddhism that there are two paths to enlightenment, and I mean it's really easy to understand what is meant by that. One is where you practice samatha first and develop these high states of concentration based on. You're welcome. Thanks for coming. Based on a concept, and as a result, your mind becomes focused, and you're able to get all these wonderful powers that are mentioned in, I think, mentioned in the Samanyapala Sutta. Yeah, for sure, they've got to be mentioned in the Samanyapala Sutta. And then you start practicing vipassana. Then after that, you focus on reality and come to understand the truth of nature and so on. The paticca-samuppada, you come to understand the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering. The Four Noble Truths. And the other way to enlightenment is to simply bypass all of that. And this is found in the can I remember? Susima Sutta, I think. If I got the name right. There's this wonderful sutta that's this guy goes up to these arahants and says, "So, are you? I heard you guys are arahants," and they just don't deny it. And he says, "So what? Can you read people's minds?" And they said, "No." "Can you fly through the air?" "No." "Can you this and that? Can you remember your past lives? Do you have any of these magical powers? Do you have these high states of jhana?" And they said, "No." And he said, "Well, then how can you possibly be enlightened?" And they said, they have been released through insight. And this is considered to be the other way of enlightenment, is to just bypass all of those states of concentration and immediately focus on vipassana meditation. Taking vipassana meditation as your focus. And this you'll see elsewhere, like in the Bahiya Sutta. Bahiya never practiced any form of meditation, and he comes to see the Buddha, and he asks for a very brief teaching. And this is where you'll often get this: is the Buddha won't say vipassana samatha, but he'll give someone a brief teaching. When someone asks for a brief teaching, he doesn't go into all of this stuff about samatha or these high states of concentration and absorption. So he said to Bahiya, he says, "When you see, let it be only seeing. When you hear, let it only be hearing. Titte tittamattang bhavisati, sutte suttamattang bhavisati, mutte muttamattang bhavisati." In what is sensed, let there only be the sensing. What is thought, let there only be thought. Let there only be what is thought. So, understanding it for what it is, and this is where we get this idea of the mantra. When you hear something, let it only be for you hearing. So we remind ourselves that it's only hearing, saying hearing, hearing. And he became an arahant as a result of that. What I meant was that the jhanas are states attained along the path, but neither of the seven jhanas are the absolute truth, nibbana, and neither should be cling to. Of course, yes, indeed. But all I just wanted to say is that they may not even have to be looked at as states. It's just sort of stages in terms of vipassana practice. At Sankarupekayana, which is the yana right before one becomes enlightened, it's very similar. It's almost exactly what the Lord Buddha said about the fourth jhana. He is mindful and equanimous. Yeah. No, I really like that commentarial passage that you'll find in various places that says there's two different types of jhana. And that makes it clear in my mind that what we're talking about, there's the jhanas in a classical sense of practicing samatha meditation. And another thing is the Samanyapala Sutta is talking about the whole path. It's talking about the way that the Buddha went. It's not talking about, the way everyone has to go. I mean, if that were the case, then you'd have to get everything that's in the Samanyapala Sutta. It could be, then you'd have to think, well, if that's the case, if I have to get everything in the Samanyapala Sutta, then I have to remember my past lives in order to become enlightened, or I have to get the Arupa Jhanas to become enlightened, or so on. It's giving the Samanyapala, which is the fruit of the of recluseship. These are things that are possible to obtain through, because the question, of course, was, well, someone who's a carpenter, someone who's a warrior, these guys, they all get their rewards. what kind of reward is there from torturing yourself off in the forest, you know, living a life of renunciation? And so the Buddha said, well, there's lots of rewards, and he gave them one after another. So it's dangerous to sort of think that you know, I have to do all of that, or I have to take that as my basis. I mean, he was also giving it to a king who was very much distressed, and he was he had committed patricide. He had killed his father. So probably good to put it in context. I mean, the best sort of concise expression of the Buddhist teaching is better to be found, I think, in the first three cardinal discourses, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, the Anattalakkhana Sutta and the Adita Pariyaya Sutta. These ones really give you a good understanding of what is core in Buddhism, I think, or in classical Buddhism. You're welcome. I hope it's helped at least somewhat. Again, these are complicated subjects. If you really want a very interesting look at the jhanas and this incredible argument that went on between these two monks, and if you're interested in the commentaries, because it's very much based on the commentaries, there's this dialogue between these two monks where one of them, he accuses the Mahasi Sayadaw, who is sort of the head of the tradition that I follow, of perverting Buddhism because he doesn't follow the Samatha Jhanas, and one of Mahasi Sayadaw's students takes up the cause and writes back to him, and these were all published, and it's an incredibly scholarly argument that just delves really deeply into the heart of classical Buddhism, and sort of makes it clear to this guy that you know, there's no need to think that you should have to, you know, and he talks about the things that I briefly mentioned, you know, the idea that you shouldn't, you know, then you would have to, is it fair to say that you have to remember past lives as well? I mean, where do you draw the line? It's clear that that's not the case. And that was, the book is called, I think, Vipassana Meditation Criticisms and Replies or something like that. Really good book. If you're a Buddhist geek, I think you'd have to be a bit of a geek to appreciate it. Yeah, if you can IM me as well, I could probably find it quicker because I know the sources. It's a really interesting, I mean, it's kind of a part of our heritage, this argument that they had. It's really an interesting dialogue. And if you look, it's really amazing. They actually write out the sources, and this is in a time where there were no computers, where it was all look it up by hand, copy it out, and it's all full of Pali footnotes and you know, references. It was an incredible work that was done, and the argument that was carried out over months. I mean, this was writing back and forth and published. It was published in a Sri Lankan journal. So it was really a good read. I mean, on my part, I really appreciated it. I think a lot of people did as well. I can probably find it on the internet. I don't know if you'd be able to. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be somehow arrogant in that sense, but I think I found it before and I know where to look. Let me see here if I can find it. Probably it's Satipatthana Vipassana, I think. Satipatthana Vipassana. See if you can find this. Vipassana Criticisms and Replies. Yeah, I bet if you put that in, you can find it somewhere. Here's the title of it. Let's see if... It's on Google. I don't know if it's... No, there's no link to it. I think there's a PDF for it somewhere. In fact, I probably got it on my computer downloaded somewhere. Why don't I take down your names and I'll IM it to you later, okay? No, it's not on Access to Insight. That's probably pretty sure. Okay, I'll take down your two names and I'll send it to you. Anybody else interested? You'd have to really be into Theravada Buddhism to really get what's being said. This isn't for the beginner Buddhist. It's two scholarly monks going at it. It's funny, I don't know where it is. I can't say that I've ever read Einstein's and Eddington's exchanges, but that sounds about right. Okay, well, if there are no more questions, I think probably we should give up the room. There's probably something at 1:30. So thank you all for coming, and hope to see you again next time.